7. It's Carlos Duncan versus State of Minnesota. I know you're both experienced attorneys. You know that you each will have 15 minutes, 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. And Mr. Bass, when you are ready to proceed, you can approach the podium. State your name for the record and who you represent at the start of your arguments.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Howard Bass, and I represent the appellant in this post-conviction appeal, Carlos Duncan. Back in 2017, Mr. Duncan was convicted of 2 counts of attempted second-degree intentional murder and sentenced to serve 367 months in prison. This court affirmed in a non-precedential opinion that conviction on direct appeal in 2019. The two issues raised in that appeal were the admissibility of Mr. Duncan's phone calls from the jail and testimony by officers about prior contacts with Mr. Duncan. The facts in this case are pretty straightforward. Back on January 3rd, 2017, two men were shot outside the Dorothy Day Center. Those two men were Danny McLaurin and Xavier Simmons. Eyewitnesses to the shooting described the shooter as a black male with tattoos on his face. The St. Paul Police Department put together a 6-photograph lineup, which was administered, shown to Mr. McLaurin. That lineup had 6 African-American males, but Mr. Duncan was the only one that had facial tattoos.
We were talking about this before we came out. So we have the lineup in front of us, and we're looking at it. When we looked at it, we could only see tattoos on the neck.
Because, right, the facial tattoos were on the left, according to the eyewitnesses, they were on the left side of his face. But because of the lineup, you've seen booking photos. You've got one that's straight on, and then you've got the profile. The photo lineup was, you know, straight on photos, so you would just see the front. Nevertheless, and I will concede.
This is what we're talking about.
It's appellant's addendum 43 is a color version, which you really need to see. Black and white doesn't do it justice.
Okay.
But,
it's this, exhibit 22.
Yes, Judge. Right.
Okay.
And if you look at the second photo on the neck, lower on the, you know, below the chin, you can see that there's tattoos.
Yeah.
There are no tattoos on the remaining 5 people. So what you've got is a lineup that has one person with tattoos, granted not where they were witnessed, but nobody else has any tattoos.
So my reading of the record is that the St. Paul City person who said it was a black male in a silver SUV with tattoos on the left side of the face. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And that would make sense unless the driver was driving right at the witness. If the driver's driving away and the witness sees the profile, the left side, that would make sense. But where there are no tattoos on the other 5, Mr. Duncan's depicted with tattoos, and if someone has tattoos on their neck, I think it's more likely, I don't think it's a stretch of the imagination to think it's more likely they've got tattoos on the left side of their face than someone who doesn't have tattoos anywhere on the photograph. Danny McLaurin was the only witness at trial.
Mr. Bass, can I come back to that? Part of the district court's findings, they're obviously all credibility findings, and the trial attorney gave explanation that this was among the issues that, well, the appellate attorney did as well to consider and consulted. They both kind of consulted, but the trial attorney, this kind of discussion we have here, doesn't that almost necessarily put it in the realm? You're right, it might very well, someone might, but you still got to look at the probabilities of success and the strategies and whether to focus on that versus other things. Doesn't it still kind of boil down to, because that's the credibility determination the judge gave that we defer to put it in the realm of no abuse of discretion in denying the petition, at least related to that issue, for all these things we're talking about. You line up 10 attorneys and five might bring a motion to consider it and five others might. Your expert would understand that. Do you understand my
question? I respectfully disagree.
Okay.
You line up those 10 attorneys, 10 of them are going to bring it. At least nine and a half. This is just black letter, first year law school. If you're a professor at a law school and you're running a clinic, a defense clinic, and this case comes in and a student says, what do I do? You've got to file the motion. It's like a drug case and you don't move to suppress the drugs.
Let me ask you this. That issue you just said was considered by appellate attorney. It was a trial issue. State says that the issues about trial attorney doing or not doing things are NAFLA barred. Why aren't they NAFLA barred?
They are not NAFLA barred for several reasons, Judge. First, the cases in our reply brief, we talk about Sanchez, Diaz, Nix, Robinson. All those cases hold that a claim is not NAFLA barred if additional fact-finding is required. If the trial transcript and the briefs are not sufficient for an appellate court to make a determination, there had to be, and that was our argument in the lower court about ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Principally, it was that they did not request a stay to conduct a post-conviction relief proceeding so that a record could be made with respect to why no, for one reason, why no motion to suppress the photographic identification occurred. It's information that's material to the application of Strickland to an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. It's information that's needed to explain the lawyer's decision and to determine whether or not an appellate court should defer to it as sound strategy, if there's a basis for it in the record. The next reason it's not NAFLA barred, Reed talks about fairness requires the review of this issue. Mr. Duncan never deliberately or inexcusably failed to raise it on direct appeal. He wanted to. His court-appointed appellate attorney chose not to. Moreover, it is a meritorious claim, and it was asserted without deliberate or inexcusable delay. Next, the interests of justice, in our opinion, require the consideration of this issue. I would cite the court to its recent decision in Loveless, as well as Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure 2802, Subdivision 11, the Minnesota Rules of Civil Appellate Procedure 10304, all of which authorize the court in cases like this to review cases in the interests of justice. And these involve fundamental constitutional rights, effective assistance of counsel, the right to a fair trial, and due process of law. Another reason it's not barred by NAFLA is because there's no unfair surprise. Loveless talks about that. This issue was fully briefed in the district court. I'd cite your attention to our memorandum in support of post-conviction relief, document 141 at pages 38 to 40, and our post-evidentiary hearing brief, document 169 at pages 9 to 10, 13 to 14, and 16 to 17. But the biggest reason, in my opinion, why this is not NAFLA barred is Vance.
I'm sorry, it's what?
Vance, State versus Vance, or Vance versus State. We discussed it in our briefs. When a party raises ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, and it's based on the failure to raise ineffective assistance of trial counsel, Vance holds that you don't get to the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel unless you can establish ineffective assistance of trial counsel. It is the appellate counsel claim here is wholly derivative from and controlled by the ineffective assistance of trial counsel. If we can establish ineffective assistance of trial counsel, then based on this record, you've got ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for failing to raise it. And if we can't, then you don't, ipso facto. And the final reason is because our brief was 44 pages. This was an issue. If you look at how we argued it, it was just, look, trial counsel was ineffective. We've demonstrated it. Appellate counsel should have raised it. And I chose not to include it because I didn't really think it added anything to the brief.
Let me ask you this. Let's move on to Danny McLaren.
Yes, ma'am.
So do you think it matters that it was the same judge who was the trial judge who then was the post-conviction judge and held a two-day evidentiary hearing? That is, that he had the opportunity, and he recalled, obviously, from the memo, his order, what McLaren's trial testimony was like, and then how he appeared during the post-conviction evidentiary hearing. And he made those credibility determinations.
In direct response to your inquiry, yes, it matters. But it doesn't control the outcome in this case. It doesn't mean it's probably better for the same judge, the trial court judge, who heard and viewed the witness's testimony at trial, to also examine the witness's testimony in the post-conviction hearing. But simply because you've got the same judge and the judge makes credibility determinations does not mean that those credibility determinations are not clearly erroneous and not contrary to the evidence as a whole or the greater weight of the evidence. The Judge Gilligan's credibility determinations do not withstand scrutiny of the record. If you compare McLaren's testimony at the evidentiary hearing with his testimony at trial, with all due respect to the post-conviction court, I think it's a mischaracterization of in his order about what he said. He answered questions, you know, directly, spontaneously, gave. If you look at McLaren's trial testimony, it wasn't like the way the lower court described it at all. He initially said things like he could not see the shooter's face. He didn't notice if the shooter had a tattoo. He didn't see the shooter, didn't know his identity. Was unaware who normally drove the SUV used in the shooting. Didn't know anyone named Los. He testified at trial that he witnessed Duncan shoot him and Simmons, but he testified at the post-conviction relief proceeding that he repeatedly told the police he didn't see the shooter and couldn't identify him. I'm sorry, the point I'm trying to make is, that's the recantation. Court, indulge me one moment. I apologize. Here it is. It's in the Biggers. The application of Biggers reveals that McLaren did not have an opportunity to view the shooter at the time of the crime. What McLaren said at trial was he wasn't looking at the SUV. He didn't see the shooter's face. Then he said he saw the shooter's face a little bit. Then he said he didn't have a clear view of the shooter. Then he said he was shot by an unknown male he could not describe. He wasn't looking at the SUV, didn't know if the shooter's window was up or down, didn't see a gun. He was unable to describe the shooter and couldn't recall furnishing any description. It's at that point that the prosecutor refreshes his recollection by allowing him to read a portion of a police report, after which he admits describing that the shooter had facial tattoos. Yet he was... At trial, he said he was unable to recognize anyone in the photo lineup. It's at that point that, again, the prosecutor allows him to read a portion of Officer Diaz's report, and then McLaren admits identifying Duncan from the photo lineup and makes the in-court identification. My point is, it's not as black and white as Judge Gilligan's order paints it, that if you dig in and you look at McLaren's short trial transcript, testimony, as well as his evidentiary hearing testimony, I think it demonstrates that Judge Gilligan's credibility determination was not sound. It wasn't based on the evidence and was clearly erroneous. There are also another huge mischaracterization or misapplication of the law. Judge Gilligan concluded that McLaurin had no reason to falsely testify. But as we demonstrated at the evidentiary hearing, he had months and months of reasons to testify falsely. When he failed to appear in court pursuant to the subpoena, he was arrested and they seized a quarter ounce of cocaine from him. He was a twice convicted felon drug offender. I see my time has expired. I will sit down and await rebuttal.
You'll have 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alexandra Meyer. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent State of Minnesota. Judge Gilligan appropriately denied relief. He presided over both appellant's trial and the post-conviction evidentiary hearing. He was best placed to determine the credibility of the witnesses, and he did so specifically in his order. He bent over backwards to allow appellant to call all the witnesses he wanted to, going so far as to grant a third day of evidentiary hearing after the formerly fugitive witness, McLaurin, reappeared, and he allowed it to reopen the record and allowed him to testify. Appellant clearly disagrees with Judge Gilligan's conclusions, but he cannot point to any error meriting reversal. Appellant first claims that trial counsel was ineffective, and he claims that she was ineffective in three ways. First, for not challenging the photo identification. Second, for not calling a potential alibi witness. And third, for not calling the owner of the SUV to testify. But on a review of the record and looking specifically at the facts underlying this case and the facts known to trial counsel at the time of trial, and looking at those facts in light of the specific findings Judge Gilligan made after hearing the testimony of counsel, what it shows is that counsel was reasonable here. She did reasonable investigation, and she made a reasonable application of the specific facts of this case, which she was familiar with, to the law that she had researched.
So on the eyewitness identification, though, on the photo array, I mean, there was no strategic reason. Well, I guess I don't understand whether there would be a strategic reason not to make a motion. It's not like it would limit her in what she could argue or question in the actual trial.
Well, it could have, because you have to remember that these Mr. McLaurin and Mr. Duncan knew each other, and that became very evident during trial when the jail phone calls were admitted that Mr. Duncan made during trial, talking about, post this on Facebook, that this dude testified against me, said it wasn't personal, it wasn't about you. And trial counsel knew that there were allegations that there was a prior shooting on Bates Avenue, and there was some, in the pretrial motions, there was Spriegel argument about whether other incidents could come in. I think it's very reasonable under the facts of this case that trial counsel could conclude she would open a can of worms, that it would become possibly...
By arguing that it was overly, the lineup was overly suggestive? I mean, that just focusing on that one, whether it's a winner or a loser.
Well, if you look at how she talks about why she didn't raise it, she's talking about the second part of the test, that it was merely confirmatory and that she did not pursue it because she didn't think she could win on that. And that is a strategic decision, not to take the time to challenge this, delay trial for something that she believes cannot be asserted with any chance of success. And she knew the case law, and she used those words merely confirmatory, and that is at least quoted in one case that counsel cites, which is Wadson, where it talks about merely confirmatory identification. So this is, she very clearly knew the case law and knew how difficult that second prong would be to fulfill. I also want to return to the facts about the tattoo itself, which you brought up originally, Judge Siegel. The tattoo in this case that the eyewitnesses were talking about was blue stars tattooed around the defendant's eye. The sewer worker, the city worker who originally told police what he saw, he said he saw an African-American male with a stocky build and like a tattoo on the left eye. Very specific. Danny McLaurin testified on August 17th at trial, page 76 of the transcript, that he told Officer Diaz about tattoos on the side of the shooter's face. Again, we're talking about the eye tattoo and not anything about a neck tattoo. Finally, and Sergeant Ferroni testified that he put the lineup together, and in doing so, he did not consider the eye tattoo, or he considered the eye tattoo to be distinctive, and he would not have put in a photo that showed that, but that he didn't consider the neck tattoo important because no witness had talked about a neck tattoo. And that's further, there's further facts that support this because if you look at the testimony about the actual administration of the lineup, Officer Diaz testified that they had discussed that the shooter was Los, meaning Mr. Duncan, before the lineup was administered. And then in administering the lineup, I believe it's page 201 of Officer Diaz's testimony, he talks about how Mr. McLaurin was in the emergency room in a hospital bed, and when he's looking at the six-pack photo lineup, he opens the first tab, and then he opens the second window, and immediately he like rises out of bed and jabs his finger at it, at the photo. And this is only the second photo he's seen, so he's seen one photo with no neck tattoo, and now one with.
Ms. Meyer, can I ask you, Mr. Bass makes a reasonable argument that it's pretty common that someone who has a tattoo here is going to have one somewhere else. So wouldn't a prudent thing to do, given what we've learned historically about photo IDs, I'm confident they could have found plenty of, because it's fairly common, photos, mugshots of individuals with tattoos at least there. So then you'd at least have a confidence that, okay, now it, the field at least level. So that we're sure when he gets out and he points right there, okay, fine, if you had three or four others that also had some sort of tattoos.
So I'm not sure that the field could be level on specific tattoos. Perhaps if they could draw in little stars beside each defendant's eye, but we're talking about a detailed tattoo. Every person's tattoo like that would be different. The case law counsel sites include...
I think his point, though, being is simply because he was the only one where I looked at the color one, too, mm-hmm. where you see it and it pops out right at you. Nothing else does, not the eye, not anything else. So my only point... if I understand what Mr. Bass is raising, is it seems reasonable, therefore, to get other individuals with some sort of tattoo, because there's no description, I don't believe, of details of the tattoo, just tattoo. And it seems reasonable that if one's got one here, they're going to have one here, or at least not unreasonable.
I'm not going to concede that it was irreparably, or that it would meet the first prong, but no matter what, it doesn't meet the second part of that test. So perhaps the Sergeant Ferroni should have chosen different photos, but he testified that the reason he chose the ones he did was because they didn't have eye tattoos. And the case law that specifically talks about when this is error, when to include a photo that's distinctive, requires reversal. It really distinguishes between whether it's unnecessarily, I forget the actual language, but whether it's unnecessary. So one case, there was a facial injury during the assault, and the officer could have put in a previous mugshot, but he put in the one with the fresh injury. Now, that's unnecessary, but that's not what happened here. Here, the officer went out of his way to not include the eye tattoos, and I think in his head, he didn't think anything of the neck tattoo, which...
Isn't the point, though, and that's what Chief Siegel was referencing, that is, well, really getting not whether you'd win, I mean, all these things are always a bit of a crapshoot, certainly, but whether it's really affirmatively a sound... strategy decision not to. Whereas I do understand better the alibi witness there, that has a little more tangible that we're all used to, that it might actually backfire, especially when there was an anticipation the evidence wouldn't come in as good as it did. I think that was the description as I understood it. But this one seems a little bit almost like, why not? And that's why I assume the expert witness, Attorney Ellis, why not? Yeah, I would do it every time sort of thing. Am I wrong in looking at that versus the alibi witness kind of a bit differently?
I think the alibi witness claim is incredibly weak compared to this claim. That doesn't mean this claim is enough Mr. Duncan does not get a new trial based on it because of the standard of deference that you give to the court, the standard of deference that you give towards trial strategy of an attorney. And if it's virtually unreviewable where a defense attorney researches the law, which she did here, knows the facts, applies those facts to the law, and says, in this case, it's not worth it. And if we are going to look at 2 years after the fact what the attorney should or shouldn't have done, then the case law is very clear that the cases where you can go and investigate that trial strategy are cases like Kimmelman, where defense counsel didn't acquire discovery. That is so far from where we are in this case, where trial counsel, knowing what she knew about the case and believing that these parties knew each other and that any challenge would lose on the fact that it was merely a confirmatory identification, she gets to make a choice about whether or not she wants to bring that motion. And this court's precedent is that we do, or you do, give deference to that decision and to the decision of Judge Gilligan, who heard her testimony and believed that, and stated in his order, that he cannot say her strategic decision was unsound. So you would have to not only, I know you're looking at it de novo as far as the legal standard, but another judge, you're not just talking about an expert witness, the judge found that her legal strategy was not unsound. And she used arguments about the photo identification in her closing argument, in her cross-examination. She pointed out that the city worker couldn't identify the defendant from the photo lineup. So that also makes a pretty significant point that it wasn't, that this neck tattoo was not so incredibly striking, that the fact that the sewer worker saw the eye tattoos but then sees the photo lineup and doesn't pick out the defendant based on a neck tattoo. So I guess that would be a factual rebuttal to your previous point that I just thought of. If I would move on to the Larrison McLaurin recantation briefly before I'm out of time. On this second issue that appellant raises, the credibility of a witness's recantation is the type of credibility determination that the post-conviction court must make based on testimony and not on a cold transcript. So when Mr. Bass is talking about all the different things that were said in the trial transcript versus the hearing transcript and pointing to individual words, in this case, because there is a judge that presided over both and he was able to notice things like hesitation, tone of voice, posture, eye contact, all those things that we always say is, or you always say is important for the fact finder to make those determinations. Here, the judge was sitting as the fact finder making the credibility determinations, and he saw the entire trial testimony and the hearing testimony, and he concluded that under the first Larrison prong that he was not satisfied that the trial testimony had been false. So anything after that is the second and third prongs, which we don't even reach because he found that he did not believe that the original trial testimony was false. And I think part of that is also due to the facts and circumstances of this case. This was a witness that did not want to testify. It was very clear he didn't want to testify. The judge had to issue a warrant to get him to come and testify. He didn't want to come back and testify, or rather, he was a fugitive from justice at the time that he was subpoenaed to come testify at the evidentiary hearing. This is not a change in circumstances. This defendant didn't want to be on the witness, you know, be on the stand testifying against another person, and yet he did. And Judge Gilligan, knowing that, could look at how he presented himself in one instance and in another instance. And while you can look at the cold transcript, I think it is not a substitution for the trial judge's understanding of what was going on. And also, I would point out that counsel has not provided any case law where this court has overturned a district court's credibility determination on this type of in this type of situation. Some of the cases involve credibility determinations without an evidentiary hearing or involve a judge getting a fact wrong, but not where a judge looks at the person and decides whether or not under the first Larrison prong this person is telling the truth or not. This, as far as I know, this court hasn't reversed under that situation based on finding that their credibility determination should be overturned. Because none of the rulings of Judge Gilligan were clearly erroneous or based on incorrect factual findings, the state respectfully asks this court to affirm the post-conviction court's denial of relief.
Thank you. Counsel, Mr. Bass.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to deference to the credibility determinations of Judge Gilligan, deference to those credibility determinations is not required if, after thoroughly reviewing the record, the appellate court concludes a mistake has been made. That's the Anderson case. I submit this is one of those cases. With respect to Judge Gilligan's determination that Danny McLaurin had no reason to lie at trial, you don't need to look at how he's testifying to make that determination, to determine that that is not based on the record. This guy got no time on a gross misdemeanor, possession of a quarter ounce of cocaine, after he'd done 5 years in prison on two felony convictions for drugs. This was 30 times the amount of drugs that would qualify for a gross misdemeanor. I mean, people don't get deals like that unless they earn them. I think the record speaks for itself.
I was going to ask you about that point.
Okay.
I'm looking at the bottom of the judge's order, post-conviction order, page 23 of that year, addendum 39. And this is about McLaurin's testimony. The judge makes this statement. Second, it is entirely unclear from this record what induced McLaurin to testify falsely. As this court understands petitioner's argument, the police who arrested McLaurin on the warrant issued during trial promised him that if he testified falsely, he would not face a felony drug charge for cocaine and crack. Did the judge get your argument right?
No. I mean, that is my argument, but the judge completely disregarded it, I believe. I mean, that was what we argued, that's what we presented, we introduced the exhibits, the paper trail, but he just said there's no reason, he saw no reason for the false testimony. I think that's a clearly erroneous factual finding. Also, with respect, Ms. Myers argued that the record showed that McLaurin and Mr. Duncan knew each other. Look at McLaurin's testimony at trial. And look at Diaz's testimony at trial. McLaurin told Diaz he didn't know this guy. Didn't know the nickname Los was introduced by Diaz during the display of the photographic lineup. Diaz suggested that Los was the shooter. This was not audio or video recorded as it was supposed to have been. And initially Diaz testified that it was recorded. But then after he testified, he went and checked and came back and testified again. Sorry, I guess I didn't record it. What I'm suggesting is, and what we've argued is, it's not just the composition, but the manner in which this photographic lineup was displayed that makes it unnecessarily suggestive. And what makes it very conducive to a very substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification is the fact that McLaurin did not know Mr. Duncan, had never seen him before. So it was not merely confirmatory, as many of those cases are that find unnecessarily suggestive photographic lineups, but the people knew one another. And it's interesting that today the state's arguing that that's the reason why the motion wasn't brought. At the evidentiary hearing, Ms. Ireland did not mention that at all. She said she thought the challenge wouldn't succeed, the motion would be, quote, pretty weak, and the motion really didn't have legs. These are, I submit, amorphous reasons. It's not strategy. You could say that in any case. Ms. Ellis reviewed her file, found nothing in the file about any consideration, no memoranda, no research, nothing like that, and described it as an everything to gain, nothing to lose situation, an error of epic proportions, absolutely unreasonable, not sound trial strategy. Going back to Judge Slater's question to me about how many lawyers out of 10 would have done this, I'm thinking now that if I were running a legal clinic at a law school and one of my students was presented with these facts and failed to bring this motion, that student would have failed the class. I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The case was well argued, and we'll have our decision out within the 90 days. Thank you.